fungi and bacteria that play roles and are found commonly hanging out with plants in soils all over the place are important in remediation because they are so able to tolerate and thrive in such a wide range of conditions.
Welcome to Applied Mycology. I'm your host, Craig, here with your other host, Leaf.
Hello.
And that was today's guest, Danielle Stevenson.
I first met Danielle back in 2016 and was immediately intrigued by her work performing community waste management and bioremediation with fungi. Since then, she's returned to academia and is now pursuing a PhD at University of California, Riverside, where she studies arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and their roles in plant heavy metal tolerance and uptake, as well as what this might mean for the use of plants and fungi together in bioremediation.
We talked about biological diversity as it relates to soil restoration and some of Danielle's interesting observations about using mushroom spawn as a remediation tool.
I started using my even contaminated spawn in my remediation experiments, and I actually found that it worked freaking way better.
She also provided helpful advice about getting started trying to perform grassroots restoration and remediation, and emphasized the value of keeping a local lens and developing a sense of place in the process.
It's not like a formula of like, okay, just like grow lots of spawn and then add it into the site, right? It's like, go learn about the site, learn about what's there, then go back and research.
Now, let's get into our discussion with Danielle Stevenson here on Applied Mycology.
Danielle, thanks for joining us. Definitely stoked to hear about your work and your perspective focus on mycology around environmental science and biogeochemistry.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, happy to be here and talk with you guys.
Yeah, it's great to get you on the show here, Danielle. We met at some point in years past and our paths have crossed here and there.
Years ago, yeah.
So maybe to start, you could just catch us up on what you're working on right now.
Right now, I'm in grad school. I'm in a PhD program at University of California, Riverside in environmental toxicology, and I'm in a soil biogeochemistry lab. So yeah, it's a whole different world. I basically wanted to get better at science and take a look at fungal roles in remediation or capacities for remediation. So yeah, my research right now focuses on arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, so the plant friend fungi that associate with something like 80% of plants around the globe. And I look at how they interact with toxic metals, so like worrisome metals like lead and cadmium and arsenic and mercury and others that we do not want in our food. We do not want to be exposed to. I look at how these AMF interact with toxic metals. It's really interesting because these completely opposite effects have been seen where sometimes arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi actually increase their plant symbiont uptake of metals. And then sometimes they inhibit toxic metal uptake in their plant partner. So that captivated me. Like, people who have studied mycorrhizae or who have studied similar systems have always been like, why did you do this? It's so complex. But that's why I'm drawn to it. It feels intense. It's a lot of work. It's very complex. But yeah, I just think it's really cool because we want both of those effects depending on the context, right? So in a phyto extraction scenario, we want arbuscular mycorrhizae to help their plant partner survive in those like harsh conditions on a, you know, a Superfund site or whatever kind of contaminated or degraded site we're working on. And we want those plants to do their job even better, you know, and take up and extract more metals from the soil as a way of removing them or stabilizing them. But in agriculture, of course, we do not want toxic metals getting up into the food crops that we eat. So in an agricultural context, it would be of great benefit if these arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi inhibited toxic metal uptake and kind of had this bouncer action of letting in phosphorus and the nutrient elements that plants need, but blocking or inhibiting the toxic metals. So I'm looking at that, and I'm looking at what kind of environmental factors and soil conditions, like what kind of physicochemical parameters may influence this effect or these different effects.
That's interesting. So are you thinking that whether or not the arbuscular mycorrhizae increase or reduce the plant uptake of the metal will be dependent on the species or the taxon of the mycorrhizae or the surrounding soil properties more so?
Well, studies have shown different things about that as well. I mean, some studies found that it's the first one. It's the fungus that matters. And other studies have said that it's the plant that is more important. And a lot of newer studies are showing that the soil properties are very important. And things like pH, presence of other microbes, not the concentration as much as the speciation of the metal.
Speciation
is really important.
Could you just define that real quickly?
Sure. So like the state that it's in, I guess. So as an example, there's, you know, typically when we talk about metals, we'll just say chromium, you know, but actually chromium, or, you know, we'll say lead, but actually lead has a chemical state, I suppose you could call it. And its state really alters its mobility in the environment. So with chromium, for example, chromium 6 is a more toxic and available form of chromium. And chromium 3, like a more reduced state for chromium, is less mobile and less toxic. So I think part of what happened is that research has often been very specialized, right? So you have like a mycologist that studies fungi and knows about fungi. And then you have like a plant person who studies plants and knows about plants. And you have soil scientists over here who know about stuff like, you know, the importance of metal speciation on mobility and fate in different environments, you know. So you have like all these different disciplines and like focus areas, and I'm realizing like through reviewing the literature on this topic, which is complex because it involves fungi that connect with plants, it involves soil, all of these are very important. So to kind of go back into the original question, like what seems to be most important? Well, our perspectives on that are changing. And there seems to be evidence that it's not so much the genus and species of the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungus that's important, although there are some that are more, I guess, tolerant to metals specifically than others. I think, I don't know if y'all know some of the major genuses within the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, but you're going to see glomus species in all kinds of environments. But then there's others like Gigantospora that seem to be more sensitive to contamination and you won't see as broadly. But then within that, there's even further refinement, I suppose, where it seems that, and I mean, you won't be surprised to hear this, I'm sure. It's intuitive. It makes sense. Fungi that have a life history of living on a metal contaminated site carry that with them to a certain extent and are more either resistant to or even resilient to toxic metals and can confer that onto their plant partner. But it's interesting because, so if you gather a bunch of arbuscular mycorrhizae from a like mine site or something that's highly contaminated with different metals, and then you grow them out in clean soil, they over time will no longer express that tolerance or resistance to toxic metals. But there does seem to be an effect there. So yeah, it does matter like whether the fungus has been exposed to toxic metals or not. It matters what the plant is, and the soil conditions seem to matter. And through my research, I'm trying to get more information on the soil conditions that matter and what their parameters are. you know, what happens if the pH changes? How does that affect metal inhibition versus uptake? What happens if we add organic matter? How does that affect it? What happens if we add in other microbes? You know, people used to really think that phosphorus was of major importance in determining like arbuscular mycorrhizal, not only just like diversity and abundance, but also interactions with metals, because phosphorus can interact with metals like lead and change their solubility and mobility. And of course, for folks who may not be familiar, phosphorus is one of the major ways that arbuscular mycorrhizae earn their living. They scavenge the soil for phosphorus that's otherwise sometimes inaccessible to plants or kind of insoluble, like it isn't available to plants. So the mycorrhizae get that and trade it with the plant in exchange for sugar and carbon, basically. But from the literature I've been reading lately, it seems that that isn't as significant as was once thought. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's one other thing. So, like I said, that like whether the AMF has a life history of exposure and familiarity with the contaminant is relevant. The soil conditions are relevant, some of them seemingly more than others, trying to figure that out. But also a really important and a really special thing about arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi is that, I mean, their cells, their hyphae are composed of, and they also excrete extracellularly, like into the soil environment around them, something called glomalin, which is this protein that gloms stuff together. It's well named, and it's super important because there's like research out there that shows that glomalin is responsible for a third of the world's soil carbon storage. So glomalin, which is this protein excreted by arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, is responsible for one third of the world's soil carbon storage.
Okay, so you're saying one third, 33% of all the carbon and all the soil in the world is in the form of glomalin.
And glomalin's namesake is taken from the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, which are the glomeromycota.
Yeah. It's basically like a sticky substance. The fungus presumably secretes it to help hold moisture around it, which is part of how it does what it does. It's part of how it gets insoluble mineral elements into a solution that they can take in and transport to their plant partner. It has all these other functions, but it turns out that glomalin also sticks to metals. And so there's like a bunch of studies out there showing how important glomalin is potentially in sequestering or kind of binding up, sticking up, storing these toxic metals in the soil. And there's some evidence that this can actually last for a really long time. Like it is technically reversible, but from what I've seen, like glomalin, so even if like an AMF excretes this glomalin into the soil and then like dies, the glomalin actually can persist for a really long time, for like decades in the soil. And so that's really great for longer term carbon storage. It's also really great for longer term sequestration of metals. So that's something that seems to be important as well that I'll be considering and looking at in my research. I mean, even spores can bind to metals too. I don't know why, but yeah, that's there as well. So there's all these factors that seem to play a role, and I'm really excited to try to kind of hone in on the conditions and the factors that are most relevant to inhibition of toxic metal uptake.
So glomalin in general, would you say it helps build the structure of the soil?
Absolutely. This glomalin helps soil's aggregate, which is super important to preventing erosion. It's important to like having a suitable pore spaces in soils for air and water and for other microbes. With regards to other microbes, AMF seem to, because they are, again, like excreting glomalin, which is, you know, increasing aggregation, which is holding moisture in these little pockets around the roots where it's really needed. it also facilitates habitat, essentially, that's suitable for bacteria that are important to plants as well, such as what are called like plant growth promoting bacteria, like Pseudomonas species, which are, I'll note that Pseudomonas is also really important in bioremediation. Pseudomonas is a genus of bacteria that they tend to hang out in the rhizosphere that, around the roots of plants and play all these functions, but they also are really widespread. When you look at the kind of proprietary blends that industrial companies use for bioremediation, they include Pseudomonas typically, and also Trichoderma and other like really common soil fungi and bacteria. Some of these same fungi and bacteria that play roles and are found commonly hanging out with plants in soils all over the place are important in remediation because they are so able to tolerate and thrive in such a wide range of conditions. To finish out that piece around the connections with the other soil biology and microbes, there's more in terms of soil biology, but another important one is the relationships between arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and nitrogen-fixing bacteria, where the AMF, again, kind of create these pockets of moisture and suitable habitat right around the roots of plants. And they are known to kind of have some relationship between nitrogen-fixing bacteria and other bacteria as well.
Do you think in terms of whether or not this type of mycorrhizae with this type of plant is going to increase or decrease metal uptake? I mean, you mentioned the soil, but then also maybe emergent biological interactions of other soil microbes might be influencing that too.
Yeah, it seems like it.
That's cool. So for the research that you're pursuing on this topic, well, what type of experiments are you doing and like what type of measurements are you taking and what type of instruments are you using?
Yeah, so this research has four parts to it, experimentally and research-wise. The first one is one I'm working on now, and it involves, because it's been shown that arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, but also just in general, any kind of microorganism plant that is found growing naturally on a contaminated site, some obviously like ability to tolerate those harsh conditions, and industrial level ones will be going out to contaminated sites or like sites with really harsh conditions and getting samples to see which microbes are there, because those tend to be the microbes that are going to be great candidates for different types of remediation. So the first aspect of my research is going out to, there's a number of different Superfund sites and brownfields that I'm getting samples from. I'm characterizing the soils for their, again, like I'm characterizing the soils very thoroughly because, again, that's really relevant. If there is some kind of screening effect based on the soil properties, that it's worth looking at. And then I'm also extracting DNA and doing sequencing to look at the fungi present in those soils, and specifically using primers that are suited to get a good read on the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, because sometimes those get missed in sequencing efforts. So that's the first part. The second part is I'm going to take those, basically put them into these little boxes that are see-through, and I'll get a plant growing in the box with the fungi to the roots and all those present. And then I'm going to apply, my lab does a lot of like XAS, X-ray absorption spectrometry, at the Stanford Synchrotron. And it's super cool because they have a new line going. It's called Bio-XAS. So typically people will bring like a soil sample or like some kind of like geological sample and like shoot X-rays at it, and then you, it can tell you what's going on with the elements and even more specifically like what their species is. So again, it can tell you not just like, oh, there's, you know, 100 parts per million in this sample, but oh, there's like, you know, there's like this much chromium 3 and this much chromium 6. So it's pretty cool. And so with the experiment, because the mechanisms through which arbuscular mycorrhizae interact with metals, very few of them have been demonstrated or like seen.
So you're saying that the XAS you're using, it measures not just total metals, it also measures the speciation of the metals. So either their reduction oxidation form or how many free electrons or their conformation and things like that. How specific are the speciation measurements on it? Is it just set for a few different types of ions? To what extent does it give you that information?
I think it depends on the elements. I think that there's better methods and like databases to compare to for some elements over others. And yeah, I haven't done this yet, so I don't have firsthand experience, but it is exciting because I just have seen one other study that used this, I guess, equipment, used this approach. And it was really helpful because you could actually see reduction occurring of the study I saw was with chromium. And so you could see the fungal hyphae basically through excreting these acids and things like that. You could see the reduction of the chromium because it changed from chromium 6 to chromium 3. And then you see it being complexed with polyphosphate and then transported into the fungal cell, where it was further complex and seems to have kind of gotten stuck into a vacuole in the fungal cell. And so the reason this is helpful is because, like I was saying, the mechanisms of how these fungi interact with metals, most of them are just more than speculation. They're like hypothesized or proposed, but not all of them have actually been demonstrated. Like there isn't evidence for them necessarily. So with this kind of imaging, we can actually see what's going on with the metals in this system.
That's pretty awesome. Because I mean, with chromium, right? If it's going from hexavalent to trivalent chromium and getting reduced, it's becoming much less toxic at that point. And then it sounds like it's also being complexed and then sequestered in the AMF and then probably not so bioavailable at that point as well.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's really exciting. And then from there, the remaining or like next steps in my research involve a greenhouse experiment where I try this in pots with soil from a partner site, brownfield, that I'm going to work with on a field study. I have these like real contaminated soils with metals. I'm going to plant edible crops, and I'm going to control for all of the soil conditions or variables very carefully. And then after 12 weeks, I'm going to change things like the pH, the irrigation regime, so like the amount of moisture in the soil, the temperature of conditions, and other things that, you know, I'll change the amount of phosphorus in the system and things like that. And then throughout the entire study, I'll be testing the plants for concentrations to see how much was uptaken. And I'll also be checking the availability of the metals in the soils and seeing if or how changing these variables affects that. And then I'll try that all on a real site in LA that I'm partnering with, a brownfield that's already been assessed by the EPA. And so I'm super excited about this part, like to have the opportunity to do more controlled experiments and see what's important and then apply it in the like real world on a real site and then see how that goes. Because I think we need all of that to bring this closer to a potential application.
It's great to hear that you've got that crucial last step lined up, because it seems like that's always the hardest one to arrange in this type of research is the actual field site. The pots are good, but they only tell so much.
Exactly. And all the literature is like pots. And then it's like people saying, okay, we need to do studies not just in pots in a greenhouse. So there's this component to the research that has relevance to climate change, because some of those environmental and soil conditions, you know, environmental factors like temperature and moisture levels, like precipitation levels, and then soil factors like, again, pH and phosphorus content and organic matter levels and presence of other microbes and stuff like that. These are all things that are known to be changing with climate change. And so originally I had set up 4 sites, so 2 paired sites in LA, and it's in like the city of LA. So it's kind of a proxy for climate change in that, I mean, it's already a hot place, the kind of heat island effect of just being like in such a big city that's paved naturally kind of raises the temperature a few degrees, and then differing irrigation regimes to mimic them. And then I had 2 in the Pacific Northwest that are experiencing massively increased precipitation and cooler temperatures. So I thought that'd be super cool. But I mean, a piece of advice for people designing experiments and studies is like, I mean, I keep getting told like I'm trying to do too much, you know, and really like, there's an elegance to more simple studies that really try to answer like a discrete question in a really good way. Because the idea is like, we have our whole lives. Hopefully, you know, it's not like you have to do everything right now. So I can like focus on doing a really good job on this questions I have and work on some of the other stuff later, hopefully.
And I know that sentiment, though, because I remember when I was designing some research in graduate school and I talked to the students above me in my own program and I told them what I was going to do. And they're like, are you sure? That's a lot. I don't know. What are you thinking? You shouldn't do all that. And I was like, and on some level, they were right, because I was still working on running samples after I'd already graduated. And I was, you know, it was over a year after I graduated that I actually submitted the manuscript for the paper. But at the same time, I feel like if I had pared it down anymore, it really wouldn't have been that interesting.
Study was super
cool. There's always a trade-off with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm just really excited to hear you talking about all these experiments you got set up and taking it from the microcosm to the field. Because I know we've had a lot of discussions in the past about how that's the missing frontier with a lot of this stuff. And so it's really cool to hear that you're in a position to actually be doing that now. And you know, all of our pontificating from the past, you know, you're making it happen. So that's exciting.
Yeah, I really had to work to make it happen, you know, because I think like in graduate level, you know, people want to see you working on mechanisms. And I've always been like, I came here because I'm interested in applications. And so for something to be closer to application, you got to address some of the gaps where you're like, well, it seems like how it is, but it's never been tried in the real world. So I don't know, like, you know, that's why it's like, I have all these aspects to the research, because you kind of have to at this type of graduate studies, you got to do some lab stuff and look at the mechanisms. And you know, it's a great opportunity to learn how to use different methods and different pieces of equipment and things like that. I've definitely learned so much.
Yeah, what kind of methods do you use for examining or assessing the arbuscular mycorrhizae?
So I use a mix of sequencing and morphological methods where I'll collect samples and extract spores. You can identify to genus usually from looking at the spores, and then I'll stain roots. I'll collect samples of the plant roots and stain them and look at them under a microscope. I mean, that's important because like the thing with sequencing is it's not very fine scale, really. Like, I mean, you don't know if that organism is alive right now or was alive a long time ago. It's harder to correlate to function. I mean, it's helpful because you can get down to like species level most of the time, like read on all the fungi that are there. But it's really helpful to, and I learned this from Mike and Evie Allen, who are just total legends in kind of the field of restoration ecology involving mycorrhizae. They really taught me how important it is to also stain roots, because then you can tell what percent colonization of the roots. So you can say like, oh, well, this, you know, like if you do a study and don't check, you know, if you just were sequencing, you wouldn't necessarily know that the fungus was in an active relationship with the plant. So I do that, those techniques as well, like root staining, spore extraction. I'll do glomalin extraction because of how important it is as well. And then for metals, the lab I'm in has an XRF. So we usually start with that to get total concentrations of metals. And then our environmental science lab has an ICP OES that has even better detection limit. And then I mention the XAS for a closer look at the metals and what's happening. And then I'll do certain types of extractions to see how available the metals are.
That sounds like a pretty interesting suite of techniques you're working with there, from the microscopy to the genetics to the environmental chemistry. You're covering a lot.
It yeah,
sounds like you are getting
really
a lot better at science.
It's pretty fascinating because, like, at a certain point, like, you're going from the concept, okay, how do we understand, like, the quality of something, right? You know, usually looking at something. But when you get down to all the different methods and techniques to quantify things, it kind of just blows up. When you're generating this data, it depends upon, okay, you also have people that are experienced in looking at and interpreting this data. Have you had any exposure to metabolomics, which is kind of the interesting intersection of where you're sequencing the genomes of the organisms and then also collecting the metabolites and then kind of trying to cross-correlate the metabolites with the genes and kind of build out a metabolic map? That kind of seems to be the current consideration, but do you think there are some directions where we can kind of understand what kind of intercalations, not only between mycorrhizal fungi and plant, but potentially between mycorrhizal fungi, plant, saprophytic fungi, and bacteria, microbe, and all the other organisms that are in the soil food web?
So, I mean, in terms of metabolomics, I haven't engaged with that. It's actually really interesting with AMF because they just had their genome sequenced very recently. And it's so funny. Again, this is something that everyone should Google if they are into it.
Or use a different, like, search engine. You know, they could use a different one too. Just throw that out there. We're not endorsing any specific search engines.
It is unfortunate we've turned
large tech companies into verbs, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for pointing that out. Look it up if you're interested. But, like, people thought that AMF were asexual. And finally, their genome, like, a few have the machinery, essentially, for sex. So it turns out that we basically haven't, like, observed them in any kind of sexual reproduction, but that they have the machinery for it. So now I haven't done any metabolomics work with AMF. I think it's honestly been a little complicated even figuring out how to sequence them because it's not super new, but in the last few years, people have been, like, figuring out the right primers and all that. I am really interested, though, in, because something that is really important with regards to metals is transporters. So metal transporters and, like, transporter upregulation and downregulation, mm-hmm. because it has been shown that sometimes toxic metals will be transported inside of AM fungal cells by a nutrient transporter. So, for example, like the phosphate transporter will co-transport. Some of this has been figured out. I'm forgetting the specifics, but it'll co-transport lead, or the iron transporter will bring in arsenic also, or something like that. So I don't know if it's because they're, like, analog in a certain way. I don't know what's going on, but I know that something is going on, and it'd be really helpful to look at that because that might be relevant going back to the beginning of our conversation where we were talking about how it's been observed that AMF from metal contaminated sites are more able to deal with metals, but that they lose that if they're not exposed to metals. So maybe it's something to do with they can sense and detect that there's, I mean, the metals are toxic to them too, right? So they have to, like, deal with them in some way. And so maybe they detect high concentrations of metals and then I don't know, maybe there's something going on there. So it would be neat to look at, but I haven't had the resources or ability to do that with this project yet.
Yeah, you're already getting accused of trying to do too much, so that sounds like quite a bit more to add on.
I did actually originally have that as part of the survey, the first phase I was talking about, and then people were like, come on, like, that's so much. Sometimes people do a whole PhD where they essentially sequence the fungi at a Superfund site and then do a deep look into that. So, yeah.
You should actually reach out to the Joint Genome Institute because they're actually looking for a lot of similar kind of related projects.
That'd be awesome.
They're kind of encouraging people to take these questions where, you know, oftentimes it's like a matter of equipment or know-how or knowledge. And, you know, oftentimes they're like, sure. That's kind of funny because people are like, the JGI is an extension of the Department of Energy. And it's like, you've already paid for it by your taxes. So you're just basically recruiting the experience of these people that have all the know-how to how to use these new tools and how to apply them.
Sweet. That's a great tip.
So it sounds like you got a pretty awesome project going on there. And hopefully you can maybe come and join us again next year later on when you've got some more results and tell us any interesting findings.
Oh, I'd love now, to.
Yeah, yeah, because it sounds like, you know, in terms of research going on addressing these types of fungi, environmental toxicology questions, this sounds very interesting and promising. And, you know, I was thinking about how when you were saying you would take these mycorrhizae from contaminated sites, and once they grew without any metals, they kind of stopped expressing those metal tolerance genes and kind of, you know, lost that ability temporarily. That kind of sounds similar to the concept with mushroom cultivators, where a strain, after it's been cultured, it's been, you know, domesticated more or less for a long time. It's just been eating easy foods and sterile environments. And then, you know, the fungus gets weaker, and it's because it's not expressing the genes of having to survive in the wild. It's kind of like that same concept going on, it seems like.
It is. Yeah. And it's something that I have definitely found in my other experiments, I guess, within DIY fungi. Like, I was so non-sterile, literally like open air in my rented house and like outside in my backyard. And it was interesting because I know people would talk about like how they observed like almost like a need to acclimatize a culture to the contaminant so that it was like faster and had all the right enzymes ready to like break it down or whatever. But I didn't actually find that in my own research. And I think I was thinking about it and I was like, I wonder if it's because my cultures were already so freaking used to stress. They were already ready to go because they didn't have these perfect conditions where they didn't have any competition, always had the perfect food. Like, right. You know, so, and I found that where, you know, I was running a spawn business and I started using my even contaminated spawn in my remediation experiments. And I actually found that it worked freaking way better, just qualitatively, right?
Uh-huh. Well, what's funny about that is that contaminated spawn, it's very
trichoderma.
Often. Yeah. And we, we had another guest on the show recently who her PhD dissertation was sampling soil fungi at a Superfund site and then eventually isolating some of these. And most of what she found was actually ascomycetes and not the white rot fungi.
Lauren?
Yeah, Lauren. And, and then she was using trichoderma as a remediator. And
no,
so, yeah,
exactly.
Contaminated spawn is very likely is better at remediating soil than clean spawn.
I know. And that's the funny thing about like ascomycota. Like, this is literally the name of a paper, a big paper. The title is Ascomycota Dominate Soils Worldwide. And it's so it's like generally those really common soil fungi that, yeah, cultivators hate, you know, because but it's so funny because it actually feels almost like a joke, you know, where people are like, damn it, like my pleurotus won't grow, you know, whatever, like it's contaminated. I'm working on this remediation project. And it's like, dude, it's like staring you in the face. This is like the, you know, it's like one, these fungi are so easy to grow. You have to like work really hard to not grow them, you know? So that's good. That's good for remediation. That's like better if they're that able to grow in like all kinds of substrates and conditions and harsh conditions. And yeah, like I said, if you look at the species in commercial blends for bioremediation, it's going to be Ascomycota. It's going to be all like Trichoderma and Aspergillus and,
Fusarium.
You know, and then again, Yeah, exactly. Fusarium, exactly. So yeah, I think it's great. I think it's funny because, you know, Leaf, I know that you do phyto remediation stuff as well and like work with plants. And so it's like the same in that realm where people are like so frustrated that there's weeds growing because they're we're putting in these other plants. And it's like, dude, those plants do not want to live here right now. It's too hard for them. But you have these weeds that are like, yeah,
it's the reductionist trap all over again, because the reality is like everyone got so hung up on the white rot fungi because they got lignin modifying enzymes. And I always think about this too, especially with like kind of cultivation. It's kind of the reason why like flood insurance is not a thing, because like despite whatever like copper chromate arsenates or whatever fungicides you put in your building materials, there's already the spores there for different molds, especially black mold. You just got to hydrate it and they'll germinate. And when you think about it, like on an ecological standpoint, right, the human concept of taking materials and isolating them, making them like stable so you can build things, like, yeah, useful for building a home, but that's like the most disturbed ecological standpoint.
Yeah.
It's like the whole concept is that these organisms, like these ascomycetes, are trying to return things back. They're basically the pathfinder species that are recycling the nutrients. So it's kind of the funny thing in general is like, well, duh, they're going to be the best ones at breaking things down, because that's like ecological ground zero. So it's really funny that everyone got hung up on this stuff, but, you know, they're going to be slowly breaking that stuff down and returning it back. And even Leaf, it was interesting talking about a project you did with the landfill of trying to like maintain the slopes, of how you inoculated a bunch of wood chips with fresh spawn and then compared them to the other slope that where you just put the wood chips down. What was the interesting finding?
Well, at the end of it, I dug up the wood chip plots and they all had, you know, they were probably all between 50 to 80% colonized with white mycelium, but the ones that we didn't inoculate tended to have more mycelium, and it was really a wild fungus that was doing it. And so we kind of learned that adding the spawn in that context wasn't really that helpful. And interestingly enough, because discretionary funding got cut for doing any sort of follow-up studies this year on the project, they did decide to start spraying the wood chips from the wood waste that was produced on site. And spraying that on their landfill slopes, and they're kind of accomplished a lot of their goals of improving the soil quality and the plant health just by layering wood chips on in addition to whatever else they were doing. And it was kind of just leveraging those wild fungi.
They're already there, and it was kind of funny. In that base pair material, there already are fungi and other microbes living in there just waiting for the right conditions to pretty much germinate and consume and then return those nutrients back to the ecosystem.
A lot of angles to come out with these things. Well, maybe let's get a little more into your previous work, Danielle, and how you got on the path of the fungi that led you to your current more formal research. It wasn't always all about mycorrhizae with you. I remember when I first met you, you were giving a presentation. It was at the Radical Mycology Convergence in 2016. And it was on, I think it was community waste management with fungi, I believe was the topic, because you were talking about some projects you were working on with trying to collect like oil rags from the bike shop and decompose them. And did you ever get analytical results on that project? And maybe you can just talk a little bit about your past work with the DIY fungi.
Sure, yeah. So I didn't get analytical results for that project. I would still love to. I did get qualitative data from the project, which I can talk a bit about. It actually ties into, just as a like piece of transition from that last conversation. Yeah, I really do think that Pleurotus oyster mushrooms are perfect for dealing with waste in closed systems. And it's great because I really think people get super excited about mycoremediation. But yeah, this is a scenario in which I think that working with decomposer fungi that are easy to grow in a contained system for the, you know, beginner even is suitable, you know, because there's so much waste out there and a lot of it is toxic and ends up in the landfill and that's bad. And it's also something like people can connect to, like a lot of projects I started were just from being curious about my own waste streams, you know? So like with the bike project The idea had come from Jay Schindler of Fungi for the People, super brilliant guy. And I think he showed us at his house one time something he had done where he like had worked with some kind of oyster on some bike rigs. And so then I was going to my community bike shop one time, and then I just was like, what do you guys do with these, you know, rags and like bench tops? And I just remember how like the guy turned red and he was like, I mean, yeah, we just like throw them in the garbage. And he showed me out back, like they had like a massive mound from just like that week of rags. Like lubricants often, especially, you know, this is in the Pacific Northwest, super rainy place, actually contain their Teflon base. They contain like petroleum distillates, but also these highly persistent pollutants.
Forever
chemicals, Teflon, you know, and like it's estimated, I'm forgetting, I had the number up earlier, but just anyways, like a significant percentage of all lubricants wash off into the environment. And so anyways, I learned as much as I could about this particular pollutant. And then I went back to the shop and was like, can I take these rags and like try to break them down with fungi? And they were like, absolutely. Why don't you do that here? And so I originally started in just 5-gallon buckets, and I looked around, like literally, so this is a bike shop, so they have lots of boxes, right? Bike boxes. So I would grow different types of oyster mycelium on sheets of cardboard in 5-gallon buckets. And I found it had a lot of different iterations and like trial and error, but I found that actually growing it on cardboard with no sterilization, no sterility, nothing worked best because you have these perfect planes of mycelium. And then I would just soak the rags and like sandwich them between layers of this myceliated cardboard.
Maximum and surface then, area.
Totally. It worked super great, but they had so many rags. And so they're like, let's just go for it. And so then we scaled up to like these 55 gallon barrels. And then I had trouble with aeration. There wasn't enough air exchange in a giant barrel of wet rags. So I had to like tweak and play with that model. And then I just, well, I did some reading and I thought, you know, this is a primary decomposer. So far, it's thought that Teflon can only be broken down at really high temperatures. And I know that, you know, it has really toxic breakdown products too. So I was like, I doubt that this like primary decomposition, this first round is going to do the trick. So then I mimicking nature from the literature all about like how awesome worms are at physically and chemically degrading organic contaminants and then kind of complexing metals as well. I then would take the lump of the giant mass of myceliated Teflon lube rags and put it in a worm bin. And so part of the reason I was doing that also was because I didn't have funds to actually test, you know, and see what kind of breakdown was happening. So this was a type of bioassay because we know that earthworms are pretty sensitive to certain types of contamination levels. And so I did this once, but because I kind of felt bad, you know, if I put like the rag in the worm bin without any treatment, then the worms would die. If I basically like decomposed that rag with the oyster and then put that in the worm bin, the worms would live and they would love it. So I kind of took that to mean that there was some extent of reduction in toxicity. And it's also cool because you end up with this soil basically that I would not use to grow food or anything, but you know, it's better than like masses of rags going to the landfill. So that was one project I worked on earlier on. And then I started to build relationships with universities to be able to do proper testing and analysis. And so later on, well, I kind of got asked to work on this project, actually. Y'all know Peter McCoy had made the video about cigarette butts.
Yeah.
In jars with mycelium. And so, but it hadn't been tested, you know, that was like a sexy thing. And so basically there's this municipality on Vancouver Island that was really concerned about cigarette butt pollution because they're like a beachy place. Right. And mm-hmm. so anyways, we worked together with a foundation there and got funding from another foundation, Vancouver Foundation. And then I partnered with a college, a local college, their chemistry department. So basically I did the experiment where I actually basically repeated what Peter and then later Alex Dorr had done with basically growing like oyster Pleurotus mycelium and then feeding it cigarette butts. But I did different treatments. So I did some different types of spawn. So I did like grain spawn versus liquid culture inoculation. And I did sterilized versus completely unsterilized. And I did actual real totally mixed cigarette butts. And so the chemistry department at this college, the students did ICP-MS and analyzed the metals and then worked to analyze the pHs as well in the butts. And then I did a 2-week treatment basically, and then tested again for pHs. And so it was interesting because I did find that there actually was not a statistically significant difference between sterilizing and non-sterilizing, which is great. Again, like in terms of moving that closer to application, right? Because it's like a whole other step if you have to sterilize. The only exception was with non-sterilized liquid culture. That wasn't as effective. Yeah, so and I just found that in general, there was like within 2 weeks, like a 75 to 97.5% breakdown. I've then looked at the different types of pHs. There's like 2, 3, 4, 5 ring pHs. They were much more efficient at breaking down the 2 and 3 ring, like the more simple pHs, and still pretty good. Like 75, 80, 85% is pretty good. But for some of those 4 or 5 ring pHs, they were less efficient. And I worked on some projects on sites as well, like contaminated sites. Those weren't just working with fungi, often working with plants, fungi, you know, mycorrhizae assisted phyto remediation, some mycofiltration. So a bunch of other projects in partnership with different ecological restoration departments at other universities and, you know, soil science and soil remediation courses and things like that. But all of those experiences really made me want to just come be in school myself so that I could, you know, just have more direct access to what I needed to work on an experiment and like do good science and have something to share after.
Awesome. One thing I do a fair bit is as much as I educate, especially in New York, there are a large amount of young people who are in high school and beginning college, you want to kind of get involved in micromediation or learn, especially through experiential education. So yeah. One thing oftentimes I try to think about ways to get them involved in understanding like how they can experiment and learn, maybe not with working with certain contaminants or certain materials that might be pretty reactive. Often this does require a fair bit of PPE. I think a lot in the micromediation aspect, there is a lot of enthusiasm, but also too, it's important for biosafety, not just for working with organisms, but also yourself as a biological entity and organism. So one thing that I've done, try to get students involved to think about it, is trying to think about, much like you did, about how we can use these white earth fungi to kind of recycle materials. But one thing I've been doing is, much of the work you've discussed has been kind of doing analytical chemistry on the products after feeding them. What are your thoughts on screening different types of fungi, doing some kind of enzyme tests? So an example of finding similar substrates to the different types of materials. For example, cigarette butts, they're made of cellulose acetate, which is a pretty similar compound, acetylated cellulose, where if you did an enzyme extract and added it to a reaction vessel with a predefined substrate, and oftentimes one thing I've done is used a test kit that was used for biofuel enzyme prospecting. So you would measure the extension coefficient of the enzyme based upon the fact that you would have a compound that would be a colorimetric indicator bound to the other end of the substrate. So you'd be screening for an enzyme slurry from either the mycelium or the tissue of a fruiting body, and then measuring from a colorimetric to say how much of the solution turned to color based on how the effectiveness of the enzyme splitting the substrates in the products. And this is something I've even thought about doing for similar concepts for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, because given the fact we look at those candidate species because there is similarity to the heterogeneous structure of lignin, very similar to those PEHs. So what are good ways to kind of teach those first principles to students who are maybe in middle school, high school, or even beginning college who may not have the means or access, or, you know, maybe their parents don't want them potentially interacting with certain materials, but still teaching those fundamental principles?
Yeah, I've done a lot of education actually in like middle schools and high schools and just in public education in colleges and universities around different aspects of mycology and environmental science and mycoremediation even. And I definitely have found that younger folks ask way better questions than when I do like workshops with adults, you know? Yeah, so I guess I can hit on the enzyme thing in a minute, but in terms of like advice for people and young people wanting to learn about remediation or for folks who are teaching people about different types of remediation, you're right. Safety is so important. And I mean, that's just like a good, you know, that's like part of the scientific practice. The first step is always research, right? Learning about the contaminant that you're working with, learning about how you need to be safe, like what kind of PPE, like protective gear and like methods and stuff you need to use to be safe when you're working with that contaminant. And then like, well, what's already known about it? What's already been done? There's so much research to start out and it's so exciting. And I really always recommend that people pick something that they are connected to. Like, I think there's often like propulsion to like go somewhere else and like do or learn remediation there. But really, like, I think it would be great if people looked around where they are and like work there, you know? So with kids, I mean, I often will tell them what kind of waste to look for and then have them collect some waste from their house for like a week or whatever in advance of the workshop, have them research it, and then mentor them in like how to design an experiment and some of the basic stuff you need to know about fungi, which totally ties into science education anyways. Yeah, what are the basic things about fungi that people need to understand if you're trying to, you know, work with them? And I honestly think that a lot of people miss that point where it's like you have to understand how the fungus or whatever organism you're working with, how they live and what they need, and you need to give them what they need so that they can do the remediation, right? You need to think about like, okay, do they need water? How much? Do they need air? How much? So that basic fungal ecology is really important. Encouraging like curiosity and people to connect to something locally and then learn as much as they can about that. And then mentorship around like designing an experiment and like getting materials together to do it. I had a cool experience last year before the pandemic where these grade 8 students at a school in San Diego reached out, which is so cool. I'm like, wow, you're in grade 8. You think about this kind of stuff. You know, there's all these fires in California and there's some mycoremediation efforts going on. So they had heard about it and they're like, that's cool. But I wonder if the mushrooms take up the heavy metals. And so they approached me because they needed help actually testing the mushroom fruit bodies for metals. So they came to the lab and like,
these are eighth graders.
Yeah, they're eighth graders. And so that's we tested their mushroom experiment where they had these mushroom grow kits and then spiked them with different metals. And then we analyzed the mushroom fruit bodies. And then I showed them like how to, in Excel, you know, make some graphs and stuff like that. And I was so inspired. I was like, this is so cool. Cause like leaf node, right? You guys know, like that's like actually a major question.
Yeah, that's, and, like, that's the less glamorous part of the science. But like that's, but then they're like, yeah. Oh, no, like tell us, show us. And that's incredible. There's always definitely the desire to maybe do more of like the hands-on, the qualitative thing. But at the end of the day, like that experiment is only as good as you are able to quantify, you know, or record or,
yeah,
you know, and even if you've learned something where you don't get the expected result, you at least document something and that passes it forward to someone to reproduce the experiment. That's something I think that is so important, especially with people that want to pursue any kind of bioremediation or any kind of interacting with the ecology, is documentation and understanding that kind of rigor. That scientific frame set may not be as like exciting as kind of inspiring, but it's something that allows you to communicate your ideas and then share. Because I think one big thing that is a kind of common trend, at least in like DIY kind of mycology community, is there's a lot of reinventing the wheel. There's not a lot of this like standard operating procedure, but that's awesome to hear the eighth graders are kind of at that level. So like, I'm just imagining like a community of having like a message board or an open commons where, you know, you get people that are like PhD level and master's students and grad students, but even like high schoolers that are having these groups with the guidance of like a scientist like yourself, kind of this whole aspect of community science together. So that's that's really inspiring and amazing. Eighth grade, that's insane.
I know. And that's another thing I'd say is like, you know, sort of mentioned this before, but like, I think when you're dealing with waste or like, even like you're talking about like a bioreactor or something like some kind of like contained system where you're, you know, you're extracting enzymes and then you're applying those to break something down. That still would be super cool if people worked with other fungi than just oysters, because there's like so much out there, even where like fungi we thought did not have the capacity to degrade lignin totally do, you know, in certain conditions. So it's like, yeah, that would be cool. But, you know, that's really an area like dealing with waste. I really think is a great area for community science and exploration around mycoremediation with regard to like actually working on super contaminated sites. I think like that can just sometimes be outside the scope of and resources available at a community level, where, you know, what probably makes sense is to actually not grow like 100 yards of oyster mycelium and then try to deal with all the maintain the conditions that it needs and, you know, and all that. And but rather to like go see what fungi and like bacteria and plants and other stuff is already there, and then like do more like leaf found, right? Where it's like, well, maybe we just need to support who's there, find out who's there, and then add more water, add organic matter, things like that. Mm-hmm. That kind of sequencing, I think that still that level of like being able to sequence, I mean, it's pretty expensive and kind of out of reach for, I think, a lot of community members.
It's actually getting more and more affordable, which is the crazy thing. Yeah, there's one company, GeneWiz, they have this system for at least for metabarcoding. So you can kind of get like a snapshot with some primer regions. But they have a service where I think it's like $40 per sample and you'll get like 50,000 reads. So for kind of explaining to people, if you're sequencing or DNA barcoding, that's usually the more affordable thing for using Sanger sequencing. It's like $5 a sample. But a lot of the next generation sequencing, the protocols are getting more and more affordable. It is a bit tricky because you do have to like, you know, extract the DNA, amplify certain regions of the fungi you want to look for. And then on top of that, you have to attach these adapters that allow you to feed it into the sequencer. So more so the technical thing, but the cool thing, a lot of community biology labs, or a lot of what I do is fitting into that. If we're really kind of getting to the point where like, we're really kind of decades away from having like that tricoder where we're going to be able to stick it into the soil, you know, or at least, you know, have a couple steps with the helping hand of some friends that have a bit more pipetting experience.
Even while we wait for that, something that people can do, and I really recommend, is just go observe, you know, if you have the opportunity. And again, it'd be so awesome if people picked a site that they're close to in some way. You know, there's definitely polluted sites everywhere and like different types of environmental problems. But yeah, find something local and then just observe it, like go spend time there or like walk around the fence or whatever. And like, there's a lot of types of observation and even collection of, you know, plant samples. You can like take soil samples and again, do root staining is super easy and see if there's like mycorrhizae, and there's still things that people can do. But I think starting there, it's not like a formula of like, okay, just like grow lots of spawn and then add it into the site, right? It's like, go learn about the site, learn about what's there, then go back and research so much, right? Like I did where I was like, oh, bike lubes, what's in that? And I'm like, oh my god, Teflon, you know. And then I'm like learning about Teflon and looking at the chemical structure, and there's so much of that initial just observation and research that can be done. And then like the other thing is, we don't have to do everything right. Like I don't need to do all of it. I don't need to know. It's so cool, Craig, like I didn't know you before, and it sounds like you have all these molecular biology skills. So now I'm like, sweet, now I can like maybe work with Craig on that type of stuff.
We should get on, you know, a call with Lauren sometime too. And there's a lot of cool techniques too. And definitely a large thing I try to do is like try to articulate it. And a big part of it too is even talking about enzymes. Like, those are a huge factor. That's part of molecular biology. Yeah, there definitely are some benefits to growing out just oyster mycelium. One example is, like, if we're swimming in cardboard boxes, you know, depending upon your municipality, you're not sure whether when you drop that off to recycling, it's either going to get recycled, sent to a paper mill and shredded up, or recycled, or if it's going to go in a landfill. So there are ways, like doing a biodigester, so that way you could myceliate that cardboard and turn it into sheet mulch that will decompose really quickly. You know, and even teaching examples of like that, of like, even though it's like, yeah, pretty simple, this is going to eat it, but you can teach an example of saying like, hey, let's pick a couple different types of mushrooms. I did an example where we're going to make a biodigester for cardboard. So we pick candidates, we use that enzyme extraction kit, and we tested it on a cellulose dimer so we could see how effective it was. And we worked with shiitake, oyster, maitake, and button mushrooms. You know, you can see that there's stronger enzyme expression on the shiitake and oyster, less so in the maitake, and way less in the button mushroom. And then you realize, like, the microbial ecology of going from primary to secondary to tertiary decomposes, whether they're breaking down the actual stronger structures, secondary allowing more of the microbial activity break it down, then, you know, the button mushrooms, which are compost-loving species. But even further, one thing I want to ask you is, so a lot of these interesting techniques, oftentimes in urban areas, like, the soil is so disturbed, there's so little fungal activity, it's mostly bacterially dominant. So adding in, like, these mushroom spawn that have maybe gone a little bit funky, that are have trick or good ways to boost the soil fungal ratio. But even further, one interesting thing that we've talked about on this podcast so far is a lot of natural farming, where your techniques, where you're maybe going to a pocket in your area where there is more ecological diversity, less disruptants, and you're basically culturing in mass the soil microbes kind of on a substrate, like this al dente cooked rice, which is kind of crazy to think about. But then you're stabilizing it and turning into like a shelf stable inoculum that you can propagate and grow out. So you're capturing a snapshot. That's something that if I was going to go back to grad school, I would study, because you're looking at like this active kind of composite organism that's can introduce to areas that are disturbed. So kind of like you were saying, like oftentimes, like you're better off doing things that are more dynamic and more messy than more controlled, right? You were talking about like, hey, like, you know, that the stressed out fungi oftentimes, not really so much they're stressed out, it's that they're kind of a community versus being this isolated culture.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that up, because it ties in a bunch of other focus areas for me as well, around like food production, food security, agricultural work, and dealing with degraded soils. And yeah, I mean, it's like, really, that's my background. That's how I got into all this stuff, is because I was doing like food system work and like farming and all that, and then an education around that, and helping set up all these farms and food gardens in elementary schools and all over. And then, you know, it was like, oh crap, the soil in urban areas and other areas is super compacted, degraded, nutrient deficient, and has heavy metals in it. What do we do about that? So that's really what actually launched me into becoming a mycologist and DIY fungi and everything. And I've done a lot of work working with farmers and teaching people how to, like, you know, you were saying with the cardboard, how to like basically look into the waste stream for safe, like non-toxic waste that you can grow protein rich medicine on, like that you can grow mushrooms on, or work with those materials.
Make it plant food, or make it microbe food that you can then bolster your soil, which will then like keep giving back and increase the nutrient density of your fruits or vegetables, because they're associating more with the increased biological activity in the soil.
Yeah. And like adding mushrooms as a crop on farms where you can grow them in places you can't grow other stuff, and build soil at the same time. And, you know, these integrated systems. So yeah, I'm way into it. And I'm way into, you know, the natural farming technique where you put out food for microbes and they come feast, and then you take them and like spread them. I'm also way into hot composting. And that's something in urban areas that's, again, you can collect all the greens and browns, the, you know, nitrogen rich and carbon rich stuff you need to make a super freaking awesome compost to use in all these kind of projects, remediation projects, just projects to help grow food and repair soil. There's so much you can do with waste. And I think that aspect of mycology that involves like increasing food security and healthy food production and food access and like sustainable agriculture is super important as well. Yeah. And like for folks who are doing the natural farming, getting all the microbes, I don't think that mycorrhizae would get in there because they really need their plant partner. But there's some ways you can really easily amplify native mycorrhizae as well for incorporation into your food production and nurseries and like restoration projects. And it's really worth it to do so because plants do way better when they have their mycorrhizal fungal partner.
Is that a method you could describe briefly here? Is that similar to the Rodale method, what you're talking about with mycorrhizae?
Yeah, the Rodale method is awesome. And so folks, you can check that out. I did a video through Telluride Festival this year on how to cultivate AMF, but you can look up the Rodale method. They have like a super awesome outline of all the steps and what to do. Yeah, and I'm curious, I know you guys are asking me the questions for the most part, but I'm curious about the enzymes, because something that seems to me to be potentially a barrier, but that could be a really cool thing, that if like bio groups and like public lab type groups could figure out, is how to, I don't know, like encapsulate or something the enzymes so that they don't get denatured when they're applied on real sites. Or is it something that you think is just like more you're working with in contained systems where you don't have to worry about them?
Yeah, so I guess when I started my journey on micromediation, getting into it, it was like, oh, like, you know, isolating the fungi and adapting it to this contaminant and then studying it. And it was, you know, it kind of does fall down like the reductionist model, which is a good way we've learned a lot. But it's just so much work, when the reality is like the more I studied fungi, the more I learned about soil, the more I learned about these communities. And the factor is like, soil is like basically like a superorganism, that they're living in together and responding to these different stressors and environments. And it's kind of like, really, honestly, probably the best method to do soil remediation is really just cultivating a broad diversity of microbes through a compost system and making, you know, compost teas that feed them. Because basically, to the example, like you were talking about these different fungi that were adapting to contaminants, often they're adapting based upon the selective pressure in their environment. Then there's also the secondary reactions, like that they have their own primary metabolism, but then the secondary metabolism, where they're not so much defending themselves from other organisms, but collaborating. And you get this emergence. The more I study soil, the more it's like, oh, it's like a superorganism. It's like kind of imagining that you have thousands of different species of organisms, from bacteria to fungi to nematodes to amoeba to microarthropods, you know, going up to, from micro to macro, which is kind of similar to us. Like, we're, as humans, we're a composite, but we're 35 trillion cells. Each of our cells have the same DNA, but we have 200 to 300 different cell types. And those are all expressing different iterations or parts of that genome, but they're all kind of orchestrated together through this kind of symphony. And then on top of that, we have our own microbiomes that are interacting with those as well, which actually we're learning a lot more control our health. So it's the factor that soil is like this very alive, dynamic thing. And
I was want to briefly speak on the concept of enzyme extraction and encapsulation as a tool in micro-remediation, because it is often discussed.
Yeah.
And as you were just mentioning, Craig, how much complexity and diversity there is in any normal soil system where these degradation processes would be happening. It's a topic that I have mixed feelings about it, I guess, because I've read research where they inoculate contaminated soil with a fungus and then they just take an enzyme extract from it growing in culture and it's liquid fermentation, and just add that liquid extract, and found that adding just the liquid extract didn't cause any significant reduction in contaminants, whereas a live fungus did. So there's some evidence that that extraction, or, you know, those enzymes in the liquid don't really do a lot. But I did read one paper where they had extracted the enzyme and it was effectively breaking down contaminants. It was, I think it was a lignanolytic enzyme from Pleurotus. But in that research, they made a very specific substance. I don't know if it was the enzymes were encapsulated or if it was that they'd made a substance that they would bind to and be stabilized. But it seemed like a pretty complex preparation that they had to make to stabilize the enzymes to get it to, you know, be able to have that effect versus other research where they just take the liquid extract and add it and it didn't really appear to do a whole lot. And then when you get into the theory of the lignanolytic enzyme degradation systems, where the schematic that's commonly presented is the fungus has this enzyme that breaks down wood and it can break down contaminants and it releases this enzyme, that enzyme breaks down the contaminant, it breaks the bond. But that's a oversimplification of what's actually happening in a biochemistry level, because the fungus is releasing an enzyme like lignin peroxidase or lactase, or, you know, one of these commonly studied enzymes that white rot fungi use for breaking down lignin. But they release that enzyme has to become oxidized, and then that enzyme itself is usually, it's too large to access the chemical bonds of the molecule it's trying to degrade. So then they have to have a co-substrate, there's different forms of them, but a smaller molecule that the enzyme oxidizes that molecule, and then that molecule is actually what oxidizes the lignin or the contaminant. And the enzyme, the lignanolytic enzyme, is only stable at a pH under 4.5, but then the actual oxidation reaction where the contaminant would be degraded has to happen at an alkaline pH. So the fungus is not only creating an enzyme to break the thing down, it's getting substrates either that it's producing itself or that it's finding in the environment. It also is releasing organic acids to create a pH gradient in the soil so that it's acidic where it releases its enzyme, but it's basic or alkaline near the surface of the contaminant. So it's like it's starting to become this very complex chain reaction, you know, facilitated in multiple components with different types of chemicals and different factors of the soil chemistry that the fungus is orchestrating, which kind of indicates that, you know, taking that and translating it into getting, you know, the chemical from the fungus and replicating that whole process might be a lot more complicated than anticipated if we're just thinking about, like, can we just get some liquid exudate from the fungus and then use it for remediation? And that's kind of like, it gets into the intelligence of nature, whether it's a single organism or, as we were just mentioning, you know, this unfathomably complex consortia of organisms in the soil.
Yeah, that's what I have read as well. I did read that Battelle, the company, developed an encapsulation technology that protects the enzymes from degradation, and then they're like encapsulated with the necessary ions and activators needed. And then the encapsulation is like this polymer that only breaks open in the presence of water or with microbial action or something. So it like ensures that the enzymes can be delivered where they're needed. Yeah, it just like helps that work. But I still hear you, Leaf, and I think about that stuff too, like how like the hyphae excrete acids that alter the pH so that all the like complexity involved. It seems very complex for sure.
You were mentioning, Craig, you were asking about trying to develop experimental designs to assess more of this diverse complexity in the soil system in a remediation context.
Yeah, definitely. Because that's the biggest question, because you mentioned that there's different groups looking at, like, learning about the effectiveness of these heavy metals being immobilized or having their redox state changed in the presence of different organisms, whether they're fungi, bacteria, plants, or even just the organic matter. So the reality is, like we kind of discussed, there's probably some interaction of all these different factors. And this is how we kind of design experiments, by looking at all these different, you know, adjacent factors and kind of realize, well, maybe there's a synthesis to be had here. That's the question, like the future of good experimental design to carefully and intentionally go through it, which is laborious, but would probably reap some good answers and do be some good science.
Yeah, I think that would be really cool. I mean, I'm so inspired by like Maker and Biospaces and Public Lab, groups like that, that are actually trying out some of this stuff. Like to try to even just answer that question a bit, like, hey, okay, well, can we find a way to encapsulate enzymes? Does it have the same effect, or is there something missing? Like maybe you get degradation, like maybe they are highly effective at degrading certain hydrocarbon-based contaminants or something, But then what about the metals and what about the other factors? So, I mean, there's some really neat questions there, and I think it'd be so cool if folks were working on that.
What factors of current research you're working on, or what kind of research are you excited about in the future, or things that maybe you'd want to try out? So maybe a bit about what are some projects you're working on right now. Maybe are there any research proposals you put together and some trials that are underway, and maybe some things that you'd like to go a direction in the future on future projects that you're waiting upon other collaborators or other kind of factors to come together?
I think right now I really have my head in my PhD research, which, as I was explaining, already has a lot of parts to it, which kind of gets into something you asked about and commented on around like interdisciplinary science. I'm definitely trying to do that. Like, I'm in environmental toxicology, but I'm in a soils lab and I study fungi. You know, I'm like the only person that studies fungi in my lab. And I at least feel very much like a weirdo in the department, you know, for what I study. But it's very interdisciplinary. And I think that people recognize that there's a benefit to that, to like bridging fields and disciplines and collaborative research that spans fields. I mean, I've always worked that way. Like, because in 2012, I unintentionally started DIY fungi just because people were like asking me to show them what I was doing and give them cultures. And then it became a thing. So then people really think of me as this like mushroom person, you know, but I have a longer history with plants and like soil. I really like, and I really see things as all connected. And I see things, like you were saying, as kind of this, it's like, I don't know, this is cheesy. It's like a symphony of life. I've always worked that way. I still work that way, even though I've been really focused on fungi. Even in my studies of fungi, there's always plants and there's other microbes and there's like soil and worms. And
as you said, they glom it all together.
Everything's got a role, you know, and all of them are important. And so right now I'm really focused on just getting my PhD research done. I am doing some stuff on the side around medicinal mushrooms, and like I am working on some other remediation projects that I'm super excited about. I founded this program called Healing City Soils in 2015. Ooh. I'm in Canada and I'm still advising on that. I'm super excited because we are now launching a bioremediation pilot project as part of that. So the project, it's like this partnership between a compost education center and two universities. So environmental science students take soil samples for free for anyone growing food and analyze them for heavy metals and other stuff. And then other students put all that data on a map using like GIS mapping. And then we have all these fact sheets and resources and workshops on like, well, what do you do if your soil is contaminated? And I launched the program because I was doing all this remediation work and like did not have money to test. And I realized it was this huge barrier. So I like set up this program to try to remove that barrier. And it was always intended to support community science around bioremediation. So I'm so excited that that is happening now. And so we're doing a pilot on a number of sites. There's some other sites that I'm super excited about, seem promising. I'm in the LA area. There's a lot of very contaminated sites around here, air, water, and soil.
Yeah.
And so I had some talks. I'm really interested in like pushing the field. And I've been invited in on some meetings with Brownfields department and some of the bigger players, and basically pitching bioremediation to them. And so it's interesting because of course they're like, well, if it's so promising, why aren't there more case studies demonstrating its effectiveness? How do we know it's effective? How long does it take? It seems like it's high maintenance, and how much does it cost? And so I'm really like focusing on my PhD, trying to get that done. But I do have some like, what is that called? Like irons in the fire? Is that what they say?
Yeah.
Some projects that I've just been long-term devoted to that I'm still technical advising from afar. And then some other projects that are kind of like potential that I'm like really hoping, I'm being patient because it'd be so cool to like, you know, Leaf and I were talking earlier. I know we probably all agree that it'd just be so rad to actually, and so helpful to be able to implement some larger bio, phyto, myco remediation projects.
Right.
So that we know and we can learn how is this applied, how effective is it, so that it can get more buy-in from the big players, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. And it can definitely relate to having many irons in the fire or many fingers in several pies as well. In a similar example, and that's kind of something I'm definitely trying to accomplish in New York City where I'm from, because we have 5 Superfund sites. We have a reality that we're one of the biggest producers of organic waste. We're getting better at capturing it. And with COVID this year, we actually had a pretty significant reduction of our compost budget, 90% reduction. So one thing I'm trying to do is work with a lot of these community composting partners. And it's looking like composting is going to be happening in a decentralized and distributed fashion, but also at the same point, provide this concept education to people learning about soil and fungi and how to be safe and how to assess things. And there are a number of partners that are doing this work, but there's a concept of much like kind of this metaphor of the soil, like how do we bring this kind of symphony together where there are many people doing similar things just adjacently who may not be, they're kind of working towards a similar goal, but they're just based upon like, they don't know that someone next door is doing something that like a function that stacks very well. So yeah, I think I'm definitely going to have to catch up with you and hear about how you kind of got this going, because I'm trying to do similar things in New York, but it's a hope how we can have these hubs in our regional cities and understanding that these cities have all these resources and materials, and oftentimes there is a desire for collaboration, but we don't realize that on either end of the city, people are saying, oh man, if only we have somewhere to test soil, or someone in the lab saying, oh man, if there are only people that wanted to study, it's kind of amazing the potential to make and fill these gaps. And that's definitely the elegant metaphor of learning about fungi. You mentioned that you started working with plants and soils and then to fungi. I kind of got into fungi, then I was like, oh, fungi, and then I'm like, oh, soils, and then microbes, and then plants. So it's kind of amazing how on either end, you kind of find yourself more of understanding the ecology at whole, whether it's micro to macro or vice versa.
Yeah, it's like on the path of discovery of understanding nature, eventually we all become interdisciplinary and learning about all the kingdoms if we're continuing on that path. I was studying ecology as an undergrad because I was like, yeah, I want to study nature. That's cool. And then the topics often seem to be revolving around how nature wasn't doing so well anymore and how it's gone in a lot of places. So then I was like, oh, you know, habitat restoration. How do you restore nature? And then at that point, it was like, well, you know, if you got bad contaminants, and well, then you got to learn environmental chemistry so you can know how that stuff works. And then, okay, and then you want to do bioremediation, and then eventually you have to learn the, you know, the microbial ecology, the fungi, the plants, all the. I guess in terms of pursuing bioremediation, it seems like the path that needs to be taken, because I've had plenty of conversations with older scientists who got really into studying phytoremediation back in the 80s or 90s and had been getting into different forms of bioremediation, and it like never quite, you know, was effective enough to be widely adopted. Not that certain strategies started to get used, but it seemed to me that, you know, if it seems like no matter which species of plant they test, they wish they could pull out more, then it's not necessarily about which species of plant you're testing. It's like which species of plant in conjunction, maybe it's a community of plants in conjunction with a community of fungi, bacteria, et cetera, so on and so forth. And you know, and I think it can be overwhelming for a lot of people because just, you know, all the stuff we've been talking about, this conversation is covering a huge range of scientific disciplines and knowledge. But it's kind of that balance of what's easy to study versus trying to learn about what's actually going on out there. And I feel like, I guess we seem to be gravitating towards the, like, how do we figure out what's going on out there? And even if it's confusing and convoluted and murky, and I know, and I appreciate, Danielle, you're talking about all your research with the AMF and the potential soil factors, and it just off the bat, the conversation was very murky and convoluted, which is very fitting for trying to work with those types of organisms and study them. And yeah, so, I mean, as we've been demonstrating, this stuff isn't necessarily simple or straightforward. And that's why I find it so impressive that you're pursuing all this type of research and work, Danielle. And do you have any closing thoughts or statements or sentiments you want to share to wrap this up?
Yeah, I think I wanted to say that it is complex, but compost, as has been mentioned, is like really effective, and compost is really easy to make. It's something that every person could make, and it's like highly effective at, you know, not only obviously building soil health, but in remediation. There's so many studies that show that like a well-made compost is a really great remediator, and even that like micro-remediation projects are so much more effective when they're composted after, or there's some kind of element of adding in other microbes and organic matter to keep the processes of breakdown and soil forming and habitat forming and ecological succession going on. Like, to me, that's very empowering and very hopeful and inspiring. Everyone can do that. That's pretty that's pretty straightforward. Yeah, and I guess I will say too that it's all very complex, but in a way to me it seems pretty simple. Like, it makes total sense to me that the more we learn and the closer we look, even with all this molecular biology advances and all these other types of advances in science, we just keep discovering that things are more complex and more interconnected than we officially knew before. And that doesn't surprise me. And so I think it's all complex, but I always think it is kind of simple in a way. Like, just again, through observation and curiosity and research, you can get to know a different organism and what it needs and how it lives. And then I even think that some of the studies that haven't worked out were, I mean, there's like this certain process that you have to follow in science that could be part of it. But also, I mean, sometimes studies are done by people who actually aren't familiar, haven't grown fungi before, or haven't grown that fungi, or haven't observed it in its natural habitat, or things like that. And so sometimes when I read certain studies, I'm like, oh, of course that didn't work. You didn't take care of the basic needs of that organism. So I'm not surprised that like it didn't work in the way that was expected.
I've heard there's a lot of compost tea research like that, where they're like, they applied the compost tea and it didn't work. But then like someone reads the methods, they're like, of course it didn't work, because that's not how you make compost tea properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I just to affirm, like, Leaf, what you had said earlier, I've had the same experience where I came back to school being like, yeah, bioremediation. And then like academics are like, oh, we're so over that. Yeah. You know, we were kind of doing that. You know, over the last like 30 years, and then kind of
such
realized,
a 90s thing.
Yeah, you know, so I was like, oh darn, you know. But I do still think there's a lot of potential, and I think, I guess the piece I'll close with is just saying, for me personally, you know, I did environmental studies in my undergrad. I was by no means a scientist. I was a curious person who like cared about everything, and I really like mycology and remediation research. Really, like, I've learned so much. Like, now I'm in a PhD in environmental toxicology, and it's been overwhelming because I got in there without the background in chemistry and biochemistry and statistics and everything else that everyone else has. But I got here from just literally doing it. Like, I just was like, oh, I'm curious about that. Like, I wonder, I'll try it, you know? And I didn't have money. I didn't have resources to do stuff. So I had to be resourceful. And that resourcefulness, I think, I'm just trying to say that, like, you know, when I started out, I did not have my own pressure cooker. I borrowed one. Thanks, Vadim, for lending me your pressure cooker, you know? So I'm just like, kind of wanted to end on that note of just saying, like, I really think it would be a good thing for the world if more people learned about and got engaged in science and did so from wherever they are. There's so much that you can do, and you can partner with academic institutions. You can learn from other people. You can share what you're learning and what you're observing. And yeah, you don't need money and resources necessarily. You don't need to have a scientific background, but you can like become a scientist through doing it, and doing it with curiosity and like observation and care, and also just like humility and patience. Because I think, especially when we're talking about remediation, I think a lot of times we just want it to like magically be better, you know, where it's like, okay, we just like put these mushrooms in and now it's totally all solved. And now we can do this everywhere in the world and it'll solve all the problems of the world. But I think it's like, yeah, staying curious, staying humble, and like being dedicated. Mm-hmm. Like there's so much that people can do together and to like advance this field and like, yeah, contribute to food security and remediation. So it's complex, but I believe that there's a lot we can still do.
Well said.
Yeah, it's almost like it wouldn't make sense if it wasn't complex. That's a great message there, Danielle, and it's very inspiring too. I mean, you're an inspiring person. I know when I met you and first heard you, you know, presenting on your work, I was very inspired. I was like, whoa, wow, I can just go home and start doing these projects. And so I think it was really great work you were doing back then, and it's great work you're doing now. You know, I'm just happy to see you taking your research to a whole new plane. I'm excited to hear the results when they come around. But in the meantime, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come chat with us here and share your valuable knowledge and insights.
It's been so fun talking to you guys. Thanks for the conversation.
Thanks to Danielle for taking the time to share her wide-ranging perspective with us. You can check out DIY Fungi at the website diyfungi.blog, and also follow her research at the University of California at Riverside.
And if you enjoy the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and follow us on social media at Applied Mycology. Thanks for listening.